Hi there, it's Jill Conrath, and I'm here today with Daniel Pink, one of my favorite all-time authors. He's written Free Agent Nation, A Whole New Mind, Drive, and Johnny Bunko. And in his most recent book, To Sell as Human, he's moved into the sales arena. And that's what we're here to talk about today. Thanks for joining me, Dan.
Jill, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks so much. And so my very first question for you is, whatever prompted a non-sales guy to write a book on selling?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. As you mentioned in your generous intro, I've spent a lot of time, almost 20 years now, writing about business, and I realized that at a certain point I'd never written about sales. And a couple of things happened. One is that I looked at my own calendar and realized how much of my own time was spent just selling, not only selling books, but just like selling people on ideas and whatnot. And then, you know, as I started doing a little bit of work, I realized I wrote a previous book called Drive that you mentioned, and that book makes an argument about rewards. And one of the conceptual takeaways in that book is that what I call if-then rewards, controlling contingent rewards, if you do this, then you get that, are good in some cases and not so good in other cases. And I started hearing from, after that book, places that said, well, what about sales? Does that mean we should get rid of sales commissions? And then I started hearing from, even more interestingly, companies that had eliminated commissions for salespeople and seen their sales go up. And so I decided that this was a topic that was, you know, a really rich, interesting topic. And, you know, there are a lot of stuff written by people who are experts in the field. I like to take something and look at it with fresh eyes and a beginner's mind. And that's what I tried to do here.
Well, and that's what I liked about your book, because you come at it not from a salesperson's perspective. You don't carry the heritage that all of us who grew up in sales bring to it. You don't have the preconceptions about what works, what doesn't work. And you actually threw yourself into the body of research that's out there and found out some very interesting things.
That's exactly what I tried to do. Look at it fresh. And the other thing that I tried to do, which is easier to do, I think, if you're not part of that whole sales community, is a principle of anthropology, where if someone outside your tribe says that your tribe is cool, people take that seriously. Whereas someone inside your tribe says you're cool, you say, well, of course, you're inside the tribe. And one of the things that I tried to do as a non-salesperson, not part of the sales tribe, is, you know, looking at it and saying, I mean, truly, it's like, good God, why don't we take this field more seriously? Why don't we admire the people who are doing this rather than look down on them? Why don't we recognize that these people are way more courageous than the smarty pantses in other parts of the organization? Why don't we recognize that selling is as intellectually sophisticated as, you know, the practice of certain kinds of law or accounting or other things that we do take seriously? And so, you know, for someone outside the field to say that, for better or worse, has, you know, people say, oh, whoa, you know, rather than, you know, if I were to say, you know, middle-aged white guy writers are really cool. Okay. No one would really care.
No, that would sort of describe you, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But if someone else were to say, you know, if someone in my daughter's generation, my teenage daughter's generation, were to say, hey, you know what, middle-aged white guy writers are really cool, people might say, oh, that's kind of interesting. So anyway, so my view is that, so I look at, looking at this world of sales, which I didn't know that well, I look at it with, not only with fascination, but with admiration for what folks do.
I think most people have no idea what goes into being good at sales. And instead, they look down on it from the schlocky perspective of the 1950s. Quack that was going around trying to sell things to people, or the telemarketers that call them at home. But real selling requires, I mean, I tell people it's a thinking intensive profession. I mean, you really have to have your brain in order to be effective at it.
And even more so now.
Yeah.
I mean, even more so today than 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago.
Yeah. One of the concepts you talk about in your book is information asymmetry. And I love that term, and I wish you would share what it is with people so that they would understand, because it really ties into what we're talking about now.
Sure, it's very simple. You know, a lot of what we've known about sales, and it's true, the sale of products and services, but even the sort of the sale of ideas out there in the world. But let's go back to products and services. Most of the world of sales that we've known about has been a world of information asymmetry. That is, the seller always had more information than the buyer. Often a lot more information.
A lot more information. Right.
And here's the thing. When the seller has a lot more information than the buyer, the seller can rip you off if he or she wants. All right? The seller has a huge advantage. And this is one reason why we have the principle encoded in our law and in our customs of commerce of buyer beware.
Right.
Buyers have to beware because they're at a huge disadvantage. They don't have many choices. They don't have a way to talk back. And they're at a huge information disadvantage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason, as you were saying earlier, Jill, that's one reason sort of the 1950s view of like, you know, schlocky and sleazy and deceitful kinds of salespeople. It's really about information asymmetry. But the thing is, it's like, in the last 10 years especially, that world has pretty much disappeared. We don't live in that world of information asymmetry.
Totally.
We live in a world of information parity, close at least to information parity, depending on what market you're in. And that's fundamentally different.
Yeah, it's a lot of salespeople are having a hard time adjusting to it because the buyer's expectations have changed. I mean, for one thing, the buyer now goes online and can check everything out and learn as much as they want before contacting a customer. In fact, research shows that they're oftentimes 60 to 70% of the way through their decision process before they pick up the phone or reach out to a company, which means they know a whole lot. And if a sales guy or a sales gal comes in and starts wanting to talk about his or her stuff and explain what they do, they're really looked down upon. And it's like, come on, you know, salesperson, wake up. I already know this stuff. I've been on your website. I've checked three people out. You know.
Right.
You know, so it's a different. Plus the talking back thing that you just mentioned is interesting too.
Oh, I think it's a big deal because, you know, this has made its way, it's making its way to the Supreme Court right now in things like in Yelp, where somebody had a bad, you know, somebody had a bad experience, or who we don't know, you know, somebody was selling cleaning services and customers weren't happy. So they complained on Yelp. And the owner of the cleaning service is saying, well, these are fake things and we got to take it to the Supreme Court to figure out whether we can reveal the identities of these people. All of which is to say is that if I have a bad experience with you, and I wouldn't ever have it with you, but if I have, you know, an experience, if I have a bad experience with a seller, if I find the seller deceitful, in the old days, I could tell my, you know, I'm sitting in my garage. I work out of my garage. So there's my next door neighbor lives over there and over there. And I could go tell my next door neighbor that I got ripped off or that this person's a sleazebag. Now I can blog about it. I can tweet about it. I can go on Facebook.
Yeah.
And so customers have a way to talk back. And believe me, if you listen to Twitter and watch what's going on Twitter, there's a lot of talking back to the point where companies have dedicated staff members whose job it is to listen to customers talking back on Twitter.
That's right.
It's a different world.
That's right. And this same thing goes into forums too. I mean, it's not just about complaining. It's about checking up on people before you buy too. So somebody will go into a forum and they're looking at making a decision on telecom or some computer system. And they'll be saying to their friends on the forum or strangers on the forum, what are you guys using? How'd you make your decision? What did you like about it? Who's good? Who's bad? What should I watch out for? And so all this is all out there, meaning that salespeople really have to be different.
And different on so many different, that word is so rich, different. Different from the way that they used to be, different from each other, different in terms of providing services and ideas and information and context and point of view that is different from what people can get online. Absolutely right.
Right. They have to learn to turn themselves into an invaluable resource themselves. They can't just think that their product or service or their company speaks for themselves. They themselves have to be the differentiator today.
Yeah, I agree. I interviewed a lot of, especially in B2B, I think that, you know, a lot of times in selling, we don't think immediately of B2B, which is obviously a gigantic part of our economy. And I interviewed a lot of B2B salespeople and every single one of them said expertise. You got to be an expert.
You have to be an expert. One of the things I liked about in your book was when you talked about problem solving versus problem finding. That was, you know, because again, my readers are B2B
readers,
my listeners. So if we can focus on that, because I really think problem finding is a crucial thing. So can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, I think it's really important in B2B. So let's say that, I mean, it goes to what you were saying earlier about customers coming in 60 to 70% of the way through the traditional sales process. Mm-hmm. And we have this notion of the sales process, say it goes from 0 to 100 on a timeline. And they used to come in at 5 or 6 or 10, and now they're coming in at 60 or 70. And so what that means is that they're already reasonably well informed. And so if they know exactly what their problem is, they can probably find the solution without you.
Yes.
You know exactly what the problem is.
Yep.
Now in B2B, where do they need you in B2B? They need you in B2B to be one of two or three vendors to bid against each other to drive down the price.
Right.
And so if you're just solving existing problems that people know that they have, that's not that valuable. What you have to be able to do is identify problems customers don't realize that they're having, surface latent problems, look down the road and anticipate problems. And so the premium has shifted from the skill of problem solving to the skill of problem finding. And it's a very, very different skill. It's not only in sales, it's in all kinds of white collar work. It's that we've sort of, you know, the era of problem solvers, problem solving still matters, but it's not the be all and end all. It's really about problem finders. Can you identify what problems people should be addressing?
So what advice do you have for that? Any thoughts or suggestions on how to be a better problem finder?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it goes to what you were saying earlier, which is this idea of this invaluable resource, this idea of expertise. What you have to do, and let's go back to B2B, readers, is I think that you have to know the other person's business better than they do. Mm-hmm. You have to know their business inside and out. And be able to look at their business and say, you know, you're caught in the day to day. Let's take a big picture view of this. Here's what I'm seeing at other businesses in your industry. Let me come in and on my sales call and tell you something you don't know.
Right.
Let me tell you something that I've learned elsewhere that's going to surprise you. And so I think it requires you want to come in there as an expert. You want to come in there as someone who knows their business inside and out, who puts yourself in their shoes and says, what can I do to help their business run better? I mean, you readers know this, but there's a premium now on insights as much as products and services. And, you know, it requires, I think, a little bit more a little bit less of the kind of smooth and yes and placating and a little bit more provocation.
It is. I really think that provocation is important. You know, it's interesting though, because a lot of people don't think that they have any expertise and they don't realize. I mean, one of the things that you just mentioned is you've been to other companies. You know, what you learn from other companies is invaluable to people because they don't get out a lot. I mean, they honestly don't get out a lot. They're in their corporate offices. They're in their small business. They're working their butt off every single day. And, you know, they don't look up too often. And if you can bring them ideas and insights from, you know, the company down the street that you worked with that's similar, that's valuable. And they don't know that.
You go into a CFO, let's say you're selling enterprise software for financial services or for CRM software, something like that. And you go in to talk to a CFO or a CIO, make it a CFO, and you go to the CFO, you know, if you start doing your regular presentation, she's going to say, okay, please. But if you go into the CFO and you say to her, it's interesting. I've been in the last month, I've talked to seven other CFOs, and here's the thing that has blindsided them. Are you interested in that? Whoa, yeah. All right.
Exactly. Here's
the thing that they said that really surprised me. Oh, okay. Now you've suddenly woken up, and that's it's a very different kind of ball game. I was just at a CFO. I just ran into a CFO who was a customer beforehand, but their company went out of business, and he was telling me why they went out of business. And I think that has some lessons for your company.
Whoa.
Okay, then you got your attention. It's very, you know, so it's a little bit of, it's not like being a jerk. It's not being a provocateur for being a provocateur's sake,
right.
But it's what experts do. Experts help you see things in new ways.
Right, and I think for salespeople to redefine themselves mentally as an expert is a challenge.
Yeah.
They really need to realize that that is their role and that they have to be problem finders,
right.
Not just solvers.
Right.
And they have to know their customers, like you said, inside and out in order to do that most effectively. So let me ask you this. This kind of ties into, I'm going to jump ahead in the questions I had for you, but you talk about servant leadership, and I really found that to be important and insightful. So can you share your thoughts on servant leadership?
Servant leadership is a really interesting idea. It actually came to the fore in the early 1970s by a guy named Robert Greenleaf, a relatively obscure management writer. And at the time, his idea was kind of radical and weird. And his idea was this. He said, or essentially what he did is he turned the pyramid upside down. He said, leaders are not at the top, they're at the bottom. And that the way that you lead, the way that one leads, is to serve first and lead next. That service to others is what gives you the credibility to lead. Now, this was looking at it, listening to it with 21st century ears, okay, it sort of makes sense. But if you go back 44 years, it was kind of a radical idea. Yeah. And it's ever so slowly taken hold. And you hear people talking about servant leadership, and at least we can have an honest conversation about it. It doesn't seem so outlandish and radical. And I think that where we are now in selling is something very analogous, in that we're in a world of servant selling, where you serve first and sell next. That service to others gives you the legitimacy to sell. And service, though, in a sales context is kind of a fraught word, because I'm not talking about customer service.
Right.
You know, I'm not talking about, oh, we answer our phones on two rings or less, or we get the pizza delivered to your door in under 29 minutes. What I'm talking about is, you know, putting yourself in to say, what can I do to serve this prospect? What can I do to serve this client? What can I do to make this other party's life, business better? Am I actually truly serving them? And that also is a shift in mindset. Wow. And the other thing about it is that, you know, again, we have this battle between short term and long term. Long term, I don't think there's any doubt that's the way to go. Short term, what happens is that, you know, it takes a little while to get it going, and you might not see immediate results from that. But I really do think that's where the world is going.
So when you say serve your customers or serve your prospects or your clients, what does it mean to you? And what do you see a salesperson doing that is service?
Okay, let's go back to our B2B salesperson again. What you go in there and do is provide some. Let's say you're ultimately selling software. Mm-hmm. I think what you go in there is you have a conversation with them as an expert and say, here are the three big trends I'm seeing in your industry, having talked to a lot of other people in your industry. Here are the three things that I'm seeing, and here are three things that I think that you guys could do better. And you're basically giving them. At some level, you're giving them free advice. You're serving them. You're saying, I'm trying to help you run your business better. Right. You're not looking for immediate remuneration on that. You're basically saying, you know, I'm here to serve you. I'm here to help you out. And it turns out, there's an example that I wrote about in the book of Mentos, which is a pretty interesting, I like it because everybody can sort of get their mind around Mentos. And it's this company, Italian company, privately held, Perfetti Von Melli, who, you know, had candy salespeople making sales calls to retailers, and they changed what they did. They changed their sales approach entirely. What they did is they now use their own data, Perfetti's data. They use some of the local data. If they can get data from the retailers, they do that. And a sales call is basically this: they go in, the sales reps go in there, and they say, you know, here, based on our analysis of the data, here is the collection of products that we think are going to make you the most money in your store. And those products might include products from their competitors. Mm-hmm. They will, because inevitably, you're not going to say no Snickers bars under any circumstances. And that's an act of service. You're serving them. And what they talk about is that they say, we've gone from selling candy to selling insights about the confections business. Now, it turns out over the long haul, selling insights about the confections business is actually a pretty good way to sell candy.
Yes.
And, you know, in the same way that if I go in there and tell you three things about your business that you didn't know,
right,
the next time I come back, you're going to let me in,
right,
in a way that the person who immediately goes into the slick presentation that he's done in every other office, and who doesn't really know your business, isn't going to be welcome back.
Right. I mean, I see a lot of people come in with their canned PowerPoint presentations ready to give the pitch that they've done, and it's always starts out, let me tell you, you know, here's a little bit about our company. We were founded in 1986.
Yeah.
We have 7 offices around the United States. We've got 14 customers or 1,400 customers, and here is the logos.
Right, exactly. Now we do the logo spray. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, here are the ones you need to know about. And, you know, I mean, when you get into professional services, they start talking about here's our people and our team and how smart they are. And it's like, that's totally boring.
Yeah.
To customers. Well,
the other thing is that people don't need you to find that out.
No.
Okay. Right. Chances are, if I am letting a professional services firm into my office as a prospective hire, I've already looked them up. I know who they are. Don't tell me that.
Right.
Tell me something I don't know.
Right. Right. Like the ideas, you know, in the research that you're talking about, the candy people, and they don't go in and say, let me tell you about all the candy. But instead they say, we've been doing some analysis and we've been in your stores and we've seen what's moved, we checked the Nielsen ratings. We've found out this information. Here's what works and here's what doesn't work. And I don't think people realize how important information is to customers. And the fact that they can be a curator of information too.
Bingo, that's it.
I mean, and by being a curator, that means that they actually have to spend time learning themselves, and they have to be a researcher, and they have to understand their market, and they have to understand their customer in more depth, and then sort it out and continually bring their customer this kind of information.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. Okay. So I have another question for you. In all your research, what surprised you the most?
I think what surprised me, one of the things that surprised me the most was the research showing that strong extroverts don't have any advantage in sales.
Why did that surprise you?
Well, because, I think I was gripped by the stereotype of the kind of back-slapping, super gregarious person as an effective salesperson.
Really?
And as someone who is not a back-slapping, super gregarious person, I said, I don't know if I could do that. And it turns out it's a complete myth that strong extroverts are the most effective salespeople. Now, what the research shows, it doesn't mean that strong introverts are good salespeople. They're not. They're stink. They're even worse. But it shows that people in the middle, what social psychologists call ambiverts, are the ones who do the best. And now it makes sense, now that I sort of think it through. But initially, I was kind of, whoa, wait a second, because you always associate salespeople with the kind of super cheery, gregarious kind of manner.
I know.
And what's funny is that veteran salespeople always kind of laugh at that idea.
Exactly.
Like, come on, you know, veteran salespeople, people who've toughed it out for a long time, kind of chuckle at that because they've probably seen those kinds of folks flame out in their lives, and they've seen these more modulated people actually really flourish. The good news is that if you look at the population as a whole, relatively few of us are strong introverts. Relatively few of us are strong extroverts, and most of us are actually somewhere in the middle. So that's kind of heartening that all of us, you know, the distribution is along a bell curve where, again, a scant portion of people are very strong extroverts, a scant portion are very strong introverts, and most of us are in the middle. It suggests that a lot of us can do this reasonably well if we're willing to do the hard work of becoming experts and so forth.
Right. So tell me specifically, or tell our listeners specifically about that research, because it is interesting research. I had never read it before either.
Oh, so it's new. There's no reason you would have. It's new. Yeah. It's just published. In the book, I was able to actually write about it before it was published. So, the research itself was finally in the academic journals, maybe only 6 or 7 months ago. And it and basically what happened, so it's a great study by a guy named Adam Grant at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. And it's a very simple study. Here's what he did. He went to a very, very large software company, and they have a large sales force. And so what he did is he measured the introversion, extroversion levels of the sales force. So, and then these folks went out and sold software. And so you had a perfect, you know, you had all the data you needed in a very clean way. We know who the introverts are. We know who the extroverts are. We know how much software each person sold. And when he plotted it out, it turned out that the extroverts did a little bit better than the introverts, okay? But neither group did nearly as well as the ambiverts. Neither group did nearly as well as the people in the middle. That the ambiverts, the people in the middle, the people who are a little bit extroverted, a little bit introverted, they ended up doing the best of all. And when you unpack that, it makes perfect sense, right?
Yes.
Because, you know, thing about strong introverts, they don't assert themselves. You have to be somewhat assertive in sales. They don't assert themselves. They're often shy. They don't want to strike up conversations. That's a big problem in sales for strong introverts. But then strong extroverts have a different problem. They come on too strong. They talk too much. They don't know how to listen. So they flop too. And it's really the people in the middle. And I like this term ambivert. It's not my term. It's been in the literature since the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Ambivert, it's sort of like ambidextrous, okay? They can go left, they can go right. Yep. They know when to push, they know when to hold back. They know when to speak up, they know when to shut up. They know when to assert, they know when to respond. And those are the folks who do the best. And again, Jill, the good news is that most of us are ambiverts.
Yes, because we're right in the middle. Somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. Somewhere in the middle, right, exactly.
Right, right.
Not strongly at the edges. I mean, you just think about a bell curve. Think about a chart, and on the horizontal axis is kind of a scale of extroversion, mm-hmm. where on the left-hand side would be strong introverts, and on the right-hand side would be strong extroverts. And the vertical axis is how many people are represented. And it's basically a bell curve, mm-hmm. high in the middle and low at the end. Mm-hmm. So most of us, you know, the vast majority of people are right in the middle. Yeah. The majority of people are right in the middle. And then more people are kind of close to the middle. And then relatively few people are on the sides.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are shocked if you take a look at who is successful. That it's off, you know, it's, you have to be the expert. So you have to spend time studying and learning. And, you know, it's not the gregarious rah-rah type of person. It's somebody who spends time learning and studying
and listening
and figuring out who they're talking to and what they're doing. And that's kind of what the whole thing is about.
Yep.
That's, again, like I said at the very beginning, one of the things I liked about your book is the research that you've gone out and done, because you brought me some ideas in the book that I had never seen before
out there
on the concept of sales. I have one last question I want to talk with you about, and that's with buoyancy.
Yes.
You had some interesting research on buoyancy that you brought to the table as well. I think we better define buoyancy, because it's one of your ABCs of closing, which is not of closing. It's one of your ABCs of selling, which is not always be closing, which is the old icky stuff. You have the ABCs are.
There are attunement, buoyancy, and clarity. And these are what the social science tells us are the platform qualities that are necessary to be effective in this world where buyers and sellers are evenly matched on information. Yeah. So attunement is perspective taking. Can you get out of your own head into someone else's head? Clarity, we talked a lot about. Right. Can you move from accessing information to curating it? Can you move from solving existing problems to identifying hidden problems? But buoyancy is a really interesting one. And I was able to get this term itself from a fellow who I love talking to, a guy named Norman Hall, who is one of the very last Fuller Brushmen in North America. He spent the last 40 years going door to door in the business district of San Francisco selling Fuller Brushes. And he said something quite remarkable. He said, you know, Dan, here's what you got to understand. The hard part about being in sales is that every day I wake up and I face, and this is his phrase, I really wish I had thought of it, I did not. It's Norman's phrase. He said, every day I face an ocean of rejection. That's what sales is, ocean of rejection. And I wish I'd come up with that. I didn't. And buoyancy is, how do you stay afloat in that ocean of rejection? And the social science gives us some clues. So some very interesting things like what do you do before an encounter, say before a sales call? It turns out that questioning your abilities is often more effective than pumping yourself up.
I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah,
I'd never heard that before.
Interrogative. It's a relatively new study. There's some interesting work on it's actually really, really interesting. It's something called interrogative self-talk. So let's say I'm going to a sales call and I say to myself, Dan, you got this, you can do this, you're awesome. Mm-hmm. That's better than doing nothing. There's no question about it. That positive affirmative self-talk is better than going in neutral. That's very, very clear. But it's not as good as going in and saying, Dan, can you do this? And if so, how? Because when you ask a question, questions elicit something of an active response. So you have to respond in a way. And so if I say, can you do this? Yeah, I can do this. I've done this kind of thing before. Yeah, I can do this. I'm totally prepared. I know this client's business inside and out. Got to make sure that I mention these two key points. Can you do this? Yeah, you know what? I know that they have one possible objection that could come up is this. I've got a great answer to that. Can you do this? Yeah. You know, in the last sales call that I did, I didn't really listen well enough. So I'm going to make a concerted effort to listen more here. What am I doing? I'm preparing. I'm rehearsing. Yeah. I'm getting, you know. And so this idea of what in some cases is called interrogative self-talk is more powerful than the positive affirmative self-talk. Again, positive affirmative. You can do this. You got this. That pump up. That's better than going in neutral. I don't want to make that clear. Like, don't go in neutral. So if you have a choice between going in and going in and pumping yourself up, pump yourself up. But your choice isn't only that. Your choice is between pumping yourself up and doing this interrogative self-talk, and it ends up being more effective. And what's interesting about this is you can take some of this research mm-hmm. and extend it well beyond sales. There's some great research on athletes that athletes who do, you know, because we think of athletes as you got this, you're, you know, and it turns out that athletes who use interrogative self-talk, a version of which is often called instructional self-talk, do better than the mere pumping. Yeah.
But can you do this? It sort of affirms in your body. It's not like you're trying to pump yourself up. It actually feels stronger. Can you do this? And my answer, yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It feels like a stronger response mentally when I say that. And then if you say to follow it up with how.
Yeah, absolutely. The how. Yeah. Because you're rehearsing, you're preparing. And so this thing, I mean, listen, you can do this. You got this. You're awesome. That actually feels good. Mm-hmm. All right. But
I don't always believe that, you know, I mean, that's the truth. I don't always believe it, you know, yeah. I mean, it's like you go into a call and you go, can I do this? It's kind of a quieter one. That's
yes,
I think I can, you know, yeah. how? Well, I need to start here. I need to do this. And it seems to bring in my mental engagement at
Bingo.
A deeper level by
Bingo.
Saying that.
Mental
yeah.
engagement at a deeper level. That's yeah. exactly what it's all about.
Yeah.
I mean, it's precisely what it's all about. Right. The other thing which you reminded me of yeah. is that, you know, sometimes if you say to yourself, can you do this? The answer is no. And that's not a bad thing because it means like maybe you shouldn't be going on the sales call right now. Maybe yeah. you're not ready to do this right now. Whereas this kind of affirmative, you can do it, you got this, kind of glosses over some of your weaknesses.
Yeah.
So it's a less, you know, intellectually honest form in some cases, not all cases.
Well, I think it is. I mean, there are some times when you shouldn't be going because you don't have the information you need. You're not prepared. You know, and to go would make things worse. And
exactly.
You would dig your own hole if you did that.
Exactly.
You also had some research in your book, too. Again, part of the reason I loved it is because of this research. And we're only talking about a bit of it today. But it was about how you explain your failures.
Yeah. This is some other interesting work. It's pretty enduring work by a guy named Martin Seligman, mm-hmm. who's one of the founders of the whole field of positive psychology, the founder essentially of the field of positive psychology, also at the University of Pennsylvania.
Hmm.
And he found in his really landmark study of insurance salesmen, and they were all men, is that the best predictor of sales success was how these people explained failure. They had a way of explaining failure that put it in a different context and that looked for ways, honest, authentic ways to say it's not entirely personal. It's not pervasive and it's not permanent. And so a lot of times, especially people who are new to sales, people who don't sort of getting their legs on just persuasion and sales in general. I mean, we don't like rejection very much.
Nobody likes it. Yeah.
Even veteran salespeople don't right. like it. You and I have written books and we're used to getting criticized every once in a while and it's part of the game and I still don't like it. I don't lose any sleep over it, but I still don't like it.
Know.
You know, some idiot gave me a 1-star review. He clearly hadn't read the book. And I'm like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
You know, but hey, that's, you know, and so a lot of times rejection feels like a catastrophe. And this explanatory style can decatastrophize that feeling, can decatastrophize the failure by saying, in an honest way, not a delusional way, you know, maybe he didn't buy not because I'm an idiot, but because the company's going to go out of business or he has a brother-in-law who's a vendor.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You know, so it's not all my fault. It doesn't always happen. We say, oh, it always happens. And, you know, okay, last week I closed the deal. So it doesn't always happen. And it's going to ruin everything permanent. Most things don't ruin everything. And so this explanatory style ends up being a way to maintain that buoyancy on that ocean of rejection.
And I think that's a really good place to end because what we've talked about is you know, we've started and talked about what makes the salesperson successful today and some of the things that are so crucial in terms of being there and serving the customers today with valuable information and being a resource. But the net of it is attitudes and how you feel about what you're doing, it's hard to maintain over time in a field where you do have that ocean of rejection. So thank
Absolutely.
You.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for sharing just some of the excellent information that's in your new book, To Sell as Human, which I'm delighted you wrote and added to the profession because as an outsider like you are, you have made our profession.
All right.
You've given us a little bit of a blessing and shown us that it's okay to be in sales. If Daniel
yeah.
Pink says it's okay to be in sales,
yeah.
it's got to be okay.
Of course. Yeah. But I do mean that. I mean, it's as an outsider, I just, you know, have a new respect for the difficulty and the degree of intellectual firepower needed in sales. I think a lot of folks, a lot of civilians don't realize that, and I have an absolute new respect and appreciation for it.
Yeah, thank you very much, because it is an important profession. It keeps our whole economy going.
Absolutely,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, so thanks for taking your time on this Saturday to share all these valuable insights. I truly
My
appreciate
pleasure,
it.
Jill. It was great talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.